Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Election Day, 1 week from tomorrow. We've been hearing about it for months, and now it's really the final stretch. More than 6.5 million people have already submitted their ballots in California, but that's less than a third of the more than 21 million registered voters in the state. So there are a lot of ballots out there still to be cast, possibly yours, and several in-person voting centers just opened this weekend. Plus, if you have already voted, there's also some stuff you'll want to hear in terms of like tracking that ballot and those sorts of things. So with all of that in mind, we're going to get you all set to vote or to track your ballot with a team of experts from throughout the Sacramento region and ready to ask any questions that might still exist at this stage. So send us your voting questions to insight@capradio.org. Again, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight, and we'll get to as many as we can. We're also tackling the issue of voter intimidation this morning with a couple of Cap Radio reporters who have spent weeks looking into the issue. That segment is still ahead. But first, if you live in Sacramento, you have undoubtedly seen yard signs for Measure A, because it's among the most contentious issues on the local ballot. This is an effort to change the structure of how the city is governed, but I should say giving more power to the mayor. Most of California's big cities use what's called a strong mayor system, but not Sacramento. The Mayoral Accountability and Community Equity Act would change that. Here to help us understand how it all works is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a while.
Good to be here, Randall. Yeah, it's been a little bit.
So help us understand how Measure A would shift the power structure in Sacramento.
Sure. So for those people who may not have already heard, Measure A is basically about changing the city's charter to give the mayor more executive power. And also, it will also add some provisions that could ensure more equity in the way city policy is created. The mayor would argue that right now, the city doesn't, he said that the city basically functions in a way that prioritizes the city's finances and not necessarily equity in the way policy is enacted. And so that is, I guess, his way of looking at how this could change the way equity is doled out in the city. It's all pretty complex when you think about it, honestly. Some people who I've spoken with have said, why is this even going to voters? It is like a pretty... it's a big issue to be tackling, particularly in 2020. But basically, Sacramento has a somewhat unusual form of government for a city of its size. Like you said, other similarly sized cities in California have a mayor council form of government where the mayor does hold executive power, kind of like the CEO of a company. Uh-huh. But in Sacramento, our city is run more like a company with a board of directors. So that's our city council. And council has to agree on all decisions that are made. Measure A would seek to make it so that the mayor would operate more as the CEO of the company rather than a board member, is the simplest way to think about it.
Yeah. So even though we have a mayor, Mayor Steinberg, his power is really about the same as all of the council members. That's how it exists now.
Yeah. You know, he would argue, yes, that, you know, if he wants to make any large decisions, it does have to come through a council vote. But, you know, I would say that people on the other side would say, no, he's still the most powerful vote on the city council. Mm. And of course, he's got his he's a mayor symbolically. So people do look to him still naturally as the leader.
He has a stronger voice because of that. He often, you know, has the sound bites on television and those sorts of things.
Exactly. He holds a lot of sway.
So, Sarah, this kind of change to the city's charter has come up before, back in 2014 under a different mayor. Why does Mayor Steinberg think that this time now is different, and also that 2020, as you mentioned, is the year for voters to decide this?
Sure. Mayor Steinberg says basically he feels like Sacramento is in a different place than it was last time this change to city governance was proposed in 2014. Here he is.
The city has changed a lot and society has changed a lot over the course of the last 6 years. 6 years ago, I don't think there was the same cry for the city to have a consistent investment strategy for its disadvantaged neighborhoods. I don't believe that there was a consistent cry to have the city adopt an affordable housing, funded affordable housing trust fund. And while homelessness, of course, has been a vexing issue for decades in Sacramento and in California, over the last 6 years, it has become an even more prominent issue.
He says a lot of the reform that we've seen activists asking for over the summer, you know, in relation to police accountability and racial justice, he says those are all things that Sacramento could address better if we had this mayor council form of government. Hmm.
And so it's a different era. And I think, again, it is time. People ask us, why would you bring this forward in the midst of the pandemic and in the midst of all of the racial turmoil? And my answer is that this is exactly the most important time to bring this kind of change forward.
So, Sarah, what are opponents saying? Because the outspoken opponents that I've heard seem to fall into the very category that he's arguing he would be helping.
Yeah. You know, we also spoke with last week, we spoke with incoming city councilwoman Katie Valenzuela. She's emerged as one of the strongest opponents to Measure A. She says she opposed this change back in 2014 and that she will always oppose this kind of move to concentrate power. Mayor Steinberg says this time around, like you heard, is different. Sacramento's in a different place. The city needs more equitable policies. People are actively asking him for that, and he would like to deliver on that.
It's complex.
There, yeah, it is really complex. I'm just going to let Katie speak for herself. Here she is.
But I know a lot of folks who aren't happy with the way things are going at the city are saying, gosh, maybe I should vote for this because it's change and maybe change will be good. And one thing I keep telling voters is that not all change is good change. Saying no to Measure A doesn't mean that the status quo is okay. It just means that this isn't the solution that we deserve. And we shouldn't be forced to give the mayor more power for such a weak promise of equity in our future.
Steinberg brought up the fact that one of the issues with the way the city's currently structured is, he said, as I mentioned, it doesn't inherently prioritize equity. Even if someone does come in and propose equity measures, it's the city manager who, he says, is in charge of the budget. And so Sacramento is always going to prioritize that budget and balancing that budget over equitable policies. Here he is on that.
The city could put the equity provisions in the city charter, and they would be as good and as strong as the piece of paper they are written on, unless they are implemented in a way that makes them the priority that they must be. And I go back to my original answer to Sarah's question, that this city traditionally and historically has viewed its role as collecting the taxpayer money and then providing the basic services with its city employees.
Hmm. And so for people really wondering, Sarah, what, give us an example of some places that do have this form of government, a mayor council form of government that Measure A is pushing for.
Sure. So this form of government, for a number of cities, it's in places like Oakland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego. They've all got a mayor council form of government. And I've heard from experts that typically say this type of government that Sacramento has is somewhat unusual for a city of its size. Typically, a council manager form of government, which is the type that we see in Sacramento, is more common in smaller cities, just because you're going to have this way you can have enough representation through city council. But as the city grows in size, it can honestly just be easier to have one person as the CEO rather than having to get the agreement of what could be an increasingly large number of city council members, which is kind of like the point that I think we're seeing Sacramento at right now, where we have heard people say, you know, there aren't enough council members that, to accurately represent the number of people in Sacramento. And so that is the argument for this form of government. And they also say that, like, with large cities, like Los Angeles, you know, there's a big churn of people coming in and out, and they may not necessarily always know their city council member because they're not necessarily always going to be natives of that city, or they might not be the most politically engaged. And so honestly, it's just easier for them to know who the mayor is. It's just one person. And the argument is that they can then hold that one person accountable. Huh. But, you know, the other argument, obviously, comes from Katie Valenzuela, who just says that this concentrates a whole lot of power in one person to control the direction that a city takes. She says it could be a progressive direction, but it could also mean a conservative direction, depending on who the mayor is under this form of government. Here she is.
I think it's not healthy. It's not reasonable to expect one person to know what 500,000 people want. And even if I can get some great stuff done under strong mayor, just as that opens up the door to progressive policies, it also opens up the door to regression, to conservative policies.
But Steinberg disagreed. Here he is.
No, because one, I do have faith in the people. And I do think to make the office of mayor in this city, give the office of mayor in this city a few more tools, will actually attract more qualified people to run for this office. And I believe that this city is a progressive city, and it will only elect a progressive mayor.
So Sacramento, it's actually not the largest city in the state that doesn't have this form. San Jose apparently does not have this form of strong mayor. They were pushing for it, but apparently have dropped that. So Sacramento has it on the ballot, so it's still there. So, So in your reporting, Sarah, does this form of government mean more democracy or less?
Yeah, you know, as always, I think it depends on how you look at it. You mentioned San Jose, which is a city that is larger, like you mentioned, and has also recently decided not to go for a mayor council form of government. They've actually, you know, I think that when we look at things this way with Measure A, I think people tend to be on one side or the other, but there are also middle grounds. And so like some potential middle grounds that aren't being proposed right now, but could be in the future is, you know, the city council could elect a mayor that could then operate as a strong council member. And so, you know, that's kind of a middle ground that I know Katie Valenzuela has mentioned in the past that is not on the ballot, but maybe it could mean kind of like having Sacramento shift to a way that might better serve an ever-growing population. But, you know, one thing that experts across the board have agreed on with a mayor council form of government is that people will know their council members less, and that in some cases, this is the point. So, you know, I mentioned an expert talked about Los Angeles with the city council mayor form of government. It's just easier for people to hold one person accountable for a city that large. And it's easy to say, okay, that's the mayor. Let's ask him to do this for us. But because of the fact that the city is just so big, people may naturally just not know their council members. And so, you know, I think it depends on what you call democracy, I suppose. So in some ways, I think the discussion is about the direction that we see Sacramento moving. A lot of people see influence and movement coming from the Bay. Could Sacramento be a place eventually that does have such a large mobile population that people may naturally know who their council member is a lot less? Is it already at that point? It's really hard for me to say.
So currently, just to sort of put a bow on this, the way that Sacramento is set up, most of the big decisions are not made by the mayor and by council in terms of spending decisions and that sort of thing. That goes through the city manager, who is currently Howard Chan.
Yes. Yeah, that is what this is one of the biggest points that Steinberg has argued for in terms of why Measure A should be enacted. He pointed to Measure U, which is something that he made as a promise to voters. He says it was supposed to go to underserved communities, but at the end of the day, it actually this year, because of coronavirus shortfalls, ended up going to plugging those budget holes, basically.
Right.
And that was something that he says he had no control over because he's not in charge of the budget. That is Howard Chan's final decision. And that is how they decided to utilize Measure A. And so Mayor Steinberg basically said, you know, he can say that he wants something to be earmarked in the budget for a specific purpose. But at the end of the day, he doesn't have the final call.
And
but
Chan is not, that is not an elected position. So the mayor's arguing that, as a voter, if you want to put someone in place who has your interests in mind, you can do that, but you can't do that if the decisions are being made by the city manager.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think opponents, though, like Katie Valenzuela, have brought up the fact that, you know, the mayor's or the Howard Chan is not an unelected official in a way. He is hired by the city council to do his job. And so, you know, it depends where you want to place the blame, I guess. But with Measure U, I think Katie Valenzuela and opponents might say, well, you know, city council could have, or the mayor could have said, that's not what we earmarked Measure U funds for. Howard Chan, you're not doing what we asked you to do. You're out. And they could vote to take him out and elect a new city manager. So it depends where you place responsibility.
Right. Sarah Mises-Tan is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter. Sarah, great info on Measure A. Thank you. And you're sticking around because you've also been doing some deep reporting on voter intimidation efforts in the 2020 election. So up next, Sarah and our Reno Tahoe colleague, Bert Johnson, are here to explain what's being done to protect your right to vote as calls for poll watchers has some wondering what they may encounter in the coming days. Later, we're speaking with a panel of election experts who can answer your questions. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
A good Monday morning to you. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And with just over a week until Election Day, we're focusing this morning on your ballots and your right to vote. This election is like none other in the U.S. as we try to stay safe during the pandemic. The president has called into question, without evidence, the validity of the current process. During the first presidential debate, you may recall, he urged his supporters to head to the polls as monitors. Here's his exchange with moderator Chris Wallace of Fox News.
Will you urge your supporters to stay calm during this extended period, not to engage in any civil unrest? And will you pledge tonight that you will not declare victory until the election has been independently certified? President Trump, you go first.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen. I am urging them to do it. As you know, today there was a big problem. In Philadelphia, they went in to watch. They're called poll watchers, a very safe, very nice thing. They were thrown out. They weren't allowed to watch. You know why? Because bad things happen in Philadelphia, bad things.
Well, in the wake of those comments, many have wondered about the possibility of voter intimidation and, based on other comments the president has made, how that could play out along racial lines. Cap Radio's race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan is right back where she was moments ago, sitting on the other side of my Zoom call. And she's been digging into this issue for weeks, along with our colleague, Cap Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter, Bert Johnson. And they're both here to lay out for us what they've found. And Bert, great to have you as part of the call.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Sarah, I'm going to start with you. How is Sacramento gearing up to prevent voter intimidation at the polls?
Sure. And so Secretary of State Alex Padilla has said that it is against the law in California to intimidate or harass a voter. He said in an earlier interview with Insight that it'll come down to basically simple common sense civility and what is and isn't harassment in terms of determining what or where that line is drawn. Sacramento County has said there will be zero tolerance for voter intimidation on Election Day. And of course, at the ballot boxes, Sacramento County has said they'll be on the lookout for fake ballot boxes. We heard that story a little while ago as well about fake boxes in Southern California, and that people who are planning to vote by mail should double check that the ballot box they're planning to use is registered on the county's website. And of course, if people do feel they've experienced voter fraud, they should log that at the Secretary of State's website. A recent poll or a recent report actually by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, sorry, that's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
Essentially the ACLED says that California is at a moderate risk for increased militia activity around the election period. And it actually also found that capital cities like Sacramento and peripheral towns are the most likely areas that might see this kind of activity around and potentially after November 3rd.
Mm-hmm. So Secretary of State Alex Padilla on the website, he has a place where if you experience something that you believe to be voter intimidation, you can log it there and the state is keeping track of all that.
Yes, sorry. I did not want to read a long URL out on air.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we'll have that link at capradio.org. So what about law enforcement, Sarah? Where are they chiming in on this?
Sure. I talked to the Sacramento chapter of the FBI, and they've said that voter intimidation at the polls is something that their office is explicitly making a focus around the election. One thing I think that's important to note about the FBI's approach, however, is that they don't track ideological groups. They track incidents related to actions that infringe on constitutional rights. So voter intimidation does fall under this category. If someone is threatening to harass voters, that is a constitutional infringement. Voting is a constitutional right, and the FBI is going to be on the lookout for that. However, actions that are constitutional rights, so groups that may be planning to protest or counter-protest, the FBI is not going to be tracking that, despite the fact that, you know, I think we have heard reports from certain groups intimidating people who have been involved in racial justice protests earlier in the summer. And that's something that, you know, experts are certainly concerned about, is that we might see some level of potential violence in the streets post-election, depending on what happens with the results. But the FBI has said that those investigations are basically going to be done on a case-by-case basis, individual by individual. Here's Robert Tripp of the Sacramento FBI office.
We only conduct investigations based on activities that point to violations of federal law. We do not track people based on what they think or what they say, unless that statement constitutes a violation of federal law. For example, if somebody says they're going to commit an act of violence, that could be a true threat, which is a violation of federal law. But just for thinking something, the FBI is not going to track that group. We're not a domestic intelligence agency. We're an investigative agency.
It's important to note, you know, we have heard from groups in Nevada City who were organizing protests for racial justice, who were pretty concerned about there being an increased level of clashes between some far right groups and their groups around the election. But, you know, like you said, they aren't going to track a group just because the group says that they think a certain way.
Right. So as I mentioned earlier, Sarah has been working on this project with Cap Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter, Bert Johnson. And Bert, we just heard about how officials in California are approaching this election. What are you hearing in Nevada?
Yeah, so first of all, just like in California and everywhere, poll watching is totally legal here in Nevada. So in terms of that, you know, people absolutely do have the right to come check out the process. And I spoke to election officials at the state level and the county level here in Washoe County, and all of them told me, we welcome observers to come to the county registrar's office if they want, or they can go to individual polling places if they want to check those out. I spoke to Deputy Secretary of State for Elections, Wayne Thorley, and he told me that, you know, although they do welcome folks to come in and be poll watchers, if they see any kind of voter intimidation, they'll absolutely put a stop to that. And echoing that too, I also spoke to the state's attorney general, Aaron Ford, and his message is essentially vote and mind your own business. So he did say that the rhetoric coming from President Trump constitutes an endorsement of voter intimidation. He put that pretty bluntly, but he said, you know, if folks support the president and they do want to come be poll watchers, they can do that. They just can't try to intimidate their neighbors at the ballot box. And he said, you know, his office in the past has prosecuted people who violate election laws here in Nevada.
So over the summer, Bert, Nevada state lawmakers approved Assembly Bill 4, which automatically sends the mail-in ballots to active registered voters. What are we seeing in terms of an impact that the all mail-in system is having?
Right. I mean, very early on in the window where you could return the mail-in ballots, they've been out for a couple weeks now. they had already received about twice the number of total mail-in ballots they got during the whole 2016 general election.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Right out of the gate. And so, you know, first of all, just to explain a bit about AB4, that was adopted to mitigate the threat of COVID-19 and ensure that people could vote without putting themselves at risk of exposure to the coronavirus. So far, the Trump reelection campaign, and I always pause to make sure I identify this correctly, because this is not the Trump administration. This isn't the government suing the state of Nevada. It's the campaign itself that's suing the state. But they've already filed suit over provisions in this law twice. And one of those was already dismissed. That suit was filed back in the summer. There's one that's currently ongoing right now, and that's specifically related to some of the ways that Clark County election officials in Southern Nevada and Vegas are approaching the question of poll watchers. Mm. Over the weekend, I went to a rally hosted by a right-wing group up here in Northern Nevada in Carson City, and Assemblyman Jim Wheeler and State Senator James Settlemyer were both at that event. Interestingly, they kind of shared the stage with a local patriot group, the Battleborn Patriots. And I heard both of them essentially repeat those talking points where they say AB4 opens us up to electoral fraud. It's important to note, too, when this passed, it passed on party lines because Democrats have a majority in the state legislature here. One of the big problems that Republicans, including the president, including state lawmakers, have said they have with the bill is they accuse it of essentially setting it up so that folks can harvest ballots and commit electoral fraud that way. They're saying you can collect ballots from other people and fill them out for them. But, you know, election officials I've talked to say there's a lot of safeguards in place, including signature verification, but there are other measures as well. And what's really interesting is I've been speaking to folks from the Nevada Native Vote Project, which is a new nonprofit seeking to expand voter engagement in tribal communities. They say that piece of it is actually super important because in tribal communities, it's very common to have multi-generational households. And it's also very common to have to drive a really long distance to the polls. So anyhow, finally, in terms of this question of voter intimidation, it's also possible that the unique structure of this election where so many ballots are being returned by the mail, it's going to essentially reduce the opportunities that people have to intimidate other voters because there simply will be less people voting in person.
And we should underscore that the claims of voter fraud are unsubstantiated. There is no evidence showing widespread voter fraud under these systems.
That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. What about President Trump's rhetoric around the election? How are people in Nevada responding to that, Bert?
Well, you know, Donald Trump has been in Nevada a couple times recently. I covered an event he had in rural Minden, Nevada, which is a small community about 45 minutes outside of Reno, close to Lake Tahoe. He repeated the same messaging where he made the unsubstantiated claims about the threat of electoral fraud. I saw him tell his supporters there, go to the polls, be poll watchers. For this project, I've been interviewing folks in the Patriot movement, and some of them are interested in following up on that. There's some interest within the movement to go keep an eye on things, so to speak, during the election. Another thing I heard from Attorney General Ford is that in Nevada, which is an open carry state, the right to vote and the right to carry a gun are concurrent rights, is the way he framed it. So essentially, yeah, in Nevada, it's legal to bring your gun with you when you go to vote. When you talk to folks in the Patriot movement who are known for having their guns in public, especially here in Nevada, every protest I've been to essentially has had a few people from a Patriot group standing nearby with their assault weapons. They say, we're not trying to intimidate. These weapons we're carrying are like a last resort for us. And we don't want to appear as though we're trying to intimidate folks from expressing themselves in the streets. But, you know, I talked to Truckee Meadows Community College political science chair Fred Locken about that issue. he completely disagrees with how they excuse carrying weapons.
When there is an open carry, I think, into the ballot area, there is an intent of intimidation. What reason would you bring a gun to vote? And so I think that for those that do it, they are sending a message to others. And as a citizen, I don't appreciate the message.
So, Sarah, what can people, or how I should say, can people stay safe in general right now if they're concerned about groups like we just heard Bert explaining, you know, people that are open carrying, which we don't have here in California, but what can people do if they're concerned about white supremacist groups, you know, getting in the way of their right to vote?
Sure. So I would say there are probably a few different ways to view this. I would say that at the street level, people who are concerned about clashes, if they're going out to demonstrate on or around Election Day, some general advice from organizers that I spoke with have been to basically have a protest buddy, to not get separated from the larger group, and to keep an eye out for people who might look suspicious in any way. But at the general community level, I think that there may be concern around, okay, so you might realize that you live in an area that does have an active far-right extremist group. What do you do now? And Daryl Lamont Jenkins, the founder of One People's Project, an anti-fascist organization based out of New Jersey, says collective community action is really important right now, too. Here he is.
So if you do recognize somebody as being a part of this, now you have the tools you need to say, okay, the community needs to rally and just basically remove this person from that position. But that takes education, that takes awareness, and that takes organization.
And you know, lastly, at the city level or the elected officials level, there's also action that can be taken. Here's Eric Ward of the Western States Center.
The first is to plan ahead of time. Do not act as if that somehow this will not happen in your community. The potential is very real, and you need to plan ahead of time. And that means having discussions with all of the credible players in one's community to be clear about what is acceptable and unacceptable. The second is to ensure that law enforcement is not seen as a biased entity in the midst of protest. If they are seen to be draconian with one side and soft gloved with the other, that is a potential for disaster in one's community. The third is to use this as an opportunity to mobilize business leaders and faith leaders, right? Those long-standing leaders within one's community, to articulate both the values that come with tangible examples of what it means to be a safe, secure community that is committed to democratic practice.
So Sarah and Bert, a lot of reporting here that you've done, and listeners can find your article about this at capradio.org. And this is part of a bigger project you're both working on that's airing later this week. What else is coming up?
Sure. Yeah. So my story coming up on Tuesday, we're looking at the historical context around these far right extremist groups and how they aren't a recent movement. Actually, they've been a part of the fabric of America since there's been racial tension. So pretty much since the Civil War. And we're looking at how the interaction of both civil rights movements with far right extremist groups can influence that overall trajectory of actual racial progress in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think overall my story looks to do what Daryl Lamont Jenkins had mentioned, which is really just to create awareness and education for people who live in and around these communities that these groups are in our midst. California may seem like a liberal leaning state, but we have, I would say, one of the largest numbers of far-right extremist groups in the country. And it is important, as we've heard, part of the important safety tips that you can take is to just be aware that these groups exist.
Yeah. And Bert, your piece is coming up on Wednesday?
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be releasing a feature story that really looks into the Patriot movement specifically here in Northern Nevada. you know, researchers I've been talking to say that's the most active branch of the far right in this moment. They have the most influence on the street. Their movement is growing, adding new members all the time. And I'm going to look at also the history of that movement, specifically here in Nevada. I've been talking to people who've been following the far right here since the 1990s, the last time the so-called militias were on the rise. Nevada's always had a critical place in the Patriot movement. And you see that in some of the recent standoffs between the Bundy family and the federal government, for instance. And then, you know, I look into also the way that the Patriot movement really defines itself in the negative. It's a movement that needs an enemy to push back against. So you saw a big resurgence of this movement during the Obama era. The birther movement was connected to the Patriot movement ideology. And of course, there's a link between that idea and President Trump. And then they also had a lot of essentially unfounded fears about the advent of really strict gun control legislation being passed under the Obama administration. Of course, that didn't happen. And then in this current moment, you know, it's a little unusual to see them be this activated while they have a president who's essentially friendly to their cause, or at least shares their rhetoric, in power. But the way that it works these days is they're responding to these ginned up threats about Antifa and Black Lives Matter activists. They're embracing Trump's rhetoric around that, and which is to say that these groups are actually a threat. The president sometimes calls them domestic terrorists. Again, there's very little evidence, or sometimes none at all, to back up what Trump is saying here. But that activates the Patriot movement. And unfortunately, experts think there's a real potential for violence, especially given the wider context of the coronavirus and the economic fallout from that.
Mm-hmm. One quick question before I let you guys go. And that is, you know, I've worked in newsrooms for decades, and I don't think that this would have been a topic that we would have spent weeks on going into a general election in the recent past. Was there something specific that, you know, happened over the past month or so that put this on your radar and said, hey, this is something that we need to dive into, Sarah?
Yeah, you know, I think it was hearing some increased fears from a lot of demonstrators, and just, you know, even in Sacramento, though there have not been any reported clashes between counter protesters and protesters who have been demonstrating for racial justice. I definitely think that there has been an increased amount of tension around these two groups kind of being wary of the intersection. And of course, Sacramento isn't alien to this. You know, we did see a neo-Nazi rally at the Capitol in 2016. And so it is a very real possibility. And I was just noticing an uptick in people kind of throwing this worry out there that there might be far-right extremist groups coming out. Be aware, be on the lookout. And I thought that they are potentially, I suppose I wondered if they were getting more activated in the lead up to the election. And I think we kind of found that the answer is yes, in a way, unfortunately.
All right, well, I got to leave it there. CAP Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, and also CAP Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter, Bert Johnson. Thanks for your reporting on this and for going a little deeper with us today on Insight. We look forward to the stories coming up on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Thanks so much, Randall.
And still ahead, a panel of elections experts from throughout the Sacramento region will join us to answer your questions. You can shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. We'd love to hear your thoughts or concerns, possibly, with the year's voting process. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Election Day is traditionally the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, but early voting, as you know, has already begun across California with more than 6.5 million ballots already cast. That includes Sacramento County, where 18 early vote centers opened their doors on Saturday. Residents can drop off mail-in ballots, get a new ballot, vote in person. You can even register to vote there. Last week, during a little staycation that I had, I put some damp laundry on our kitchen table and inadvertently sealed my empty ballot envelope in the process. So when I went to put my ballot inside, I couldn't do it without ripping it open. So I did pop by. It wasn't how I was going to vote by mail, but I ended up popping by one of those vote centers on Saturday, and the staff at the Oak Park Community Center made it super easy for me. They just printed out a new address sticker and then popped it on a new envelope, and then I put my ballot inside and dropped it in the box. The Golden One Center is also one of the early vote centers that debuted over the weekend. It's the largest vote center in the region. Joining us now with more on voting and early vote efforts in the region is Sacramento County Public Information Officer Jana Haynes. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Randall. Appreciate it.
You bet. So we just mentioned how 18 early vote centers opened their doors on Saturday. Can you tell us how things went over the weekend?
Yeah, things were they were pretty slow, which is very typical for these really early voting days. We had almost 1,600 people come and vote in person over Saturday and Sunday, which is a very respectable turnout, but nothing in comparison to the vote by mail and drop off ballots that we've received back so far.
Mm. And the Golden One Center, was that a draw?
The Golden One Center was a draw. It was our third busiest location over the weekend. And I think that it will continue to be a draw, but I think Election Day is probably when we're going to see the most turnout at that specific location. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a draw for the media, though. It's gorgeous, it's huge, and they love it.
Jana, I want to ask you about masks at the centers. Are you getting people that are showing up without masks? And if that happens, what do you do?
So far, that hasn't been an issue, but we do have contingency plans. We have a lot of signage that asks that people wear a mask. And if they don't have a mask, we have masks for them in the event that somebody refuses to wear a mask, either for medical reasons or just they don't want to. We do have a procedure in place to kind of ask them to wait over to the side. We set them up a very secure and secluded voting booth so that they're away from staff and other voters and kind of hustle them in and hustle them out as quickly as possible. But mm-hmm. we will not deny someone the right to vote because they're not wearing a mask.
Where is the county right now in terms of the total number of ballots that have been either mailed or dropped off at the boxes or through the voting centers?
So through yesterday, we had 292,541 vote by mail / drop box ballots back. Mm. So huge, huge increase from where we were at this point in 2018, which was only 125,000. So the early voting, the results so far have been really nice to see people taking advantage of not only those no contact options, but of the early voting. And I think that we're going to see probably more than 90% of our turnout come back through the mail or through a drop box.
And I imagine that there is special COVID-19 protocol at these vote centers. I know that the place where I vote, it's in a much larger room than it was before, I guess, to give people more space. The pen I used, I was told, just go ahead and keep it.
Exactly.
And then they also had me use hand sanitizer to seal the envelope.
Yeah, so there's a couple different procedures that are taking place that are unique to this specific election. Not only are all of our vote center locations, they are operating at a maximum capacity, which is less people inside than they would have historically. We definitely requested, you know, larger rooms in circumstances where we could get them. And then we have, you know, very specific social distancing markers for people that are standing in line. The voting booths are spread farther out to adhere to social distancing guidelines. All of our staff working the centers have their protective equipment on all day. We have shields in place between where the voter will come and get their information and the staff behind it. And obviously we talked about masks already, and then sanitation for all of the shared spaces. So all of the voting booths are sanitized between users. As you said, instead of trying to sanitize the pins, they're just sending them home with you. And obviously, because of the nature of COVID and how it's transmitted through saliva or droplets, the less saliva we can have in the atmosphere, the better. So using some other kind of moist option, such as hand sanitizer, to do the envelopes is better than if people were to lick them.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in El Dorado County now, which has seen strong early voter turnout leading up to Election Day. And joining us is the Registrar of Voters for El Dorado County, Bill O'Neill. Bill, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Randall. It's great to be on.
Yeah. So has El Dorado County seen any of those unauthorized vote boxes set up to collect ballots?
We haven't. We haven't seen any at all. We've had great response from our community, where they've been calling in to ensure that the drop boxes that we have out there are indeed authorized drop boxes. But we haven't seen any illegal or misleading ones out there at all.
So they see a drop box, and then before putting their ballot in it, they check with you to make sure it's the real deal?
Yeah, some people have been calling. They also visit our website to check the locations, because we have the locations listed on our website. So yeah, we've definitely had people looking out for it.
El Dorado County, of course, is, you know, positioned in that area where we're getting those strong winds, and PG&E is doing those preventative power shutoffs. What happens if PG&E turns off power on Election Day?
That's a great question. I was actually just talking with a counterpart on that. So seven of our vote centers, we have 13 vote centers, seven of them have generators that will automatically switch on. There'll be a blip of no electricity for like 30 seconds to a minute, but all of our equipment is on battery backup, so that'll be okay. Then the other six vote centers, we've purchased generators that we have here. They're fueled up, tested, ready to go. So if we hear that there's going to be a power shutoff, we'll deploy them out to those vote centers with the appropriate extension cords and other things to set them up, along with emergency lighting and other things to keep the vote centers open.
And you heard...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. You were going to say, continue?
The building that we're in has a generator backup. So the power went out over the weekend. It automatically kicked on. So when we came in, everything was all up and running. So tabulation, receiving in mail ballots, everything, we're good to go here.
All right. And quick numbers. It's looking much stronger than 4 years ago?
Very much so. We're probably about double where we were 4 years ago. We've had over 52,000 out of 135,000 returns so far.
All right, let's turn to Solano County. They're managing with early voting efforts and challenges, of course. John Gardner is the Assistant Registrar of Voters for Solano County. And nice to have you here, John.
Good morning, Randall. Nice to be here.
So do I understand tomorrow's the last day that your office can mail out ballots to voters? Is that right?
That's correct. We put out a press release letting people know if you have not received your ballot already, contact us today. Tomorrow will be the last day that we'll send them in the mail, but the sooner we can get that out to voters, the better.
So what do you suggest people do? Should they make that request at the last minute, or is there a better option that you would rather see?
You can call our office, 707-784-6675. We also have an email hotline, elections@solanocounty.com.
Mm-hmm. Your office a few weeks ago hit a snag when the voter guides that were sent out were missing some information. What happened there?
We did have a few people in our jurisdiction missing some candidates in their voter guides. The ballot was correct that they had, but we contacted them by email or text message for those that we had. And then we also sent a new voter guide out to those folks right away.
John, you heard Bill and Jenna talk about the vote turnout so far. What's the story in Solano County?
Very similar. We're about 2.5 times what we would have been in a 2016 election. We've got about 33% of the ballots returned already.
All right. Well, that is Assistant Registrar of Voters for Solano County, John Gardner. Also, a big thank you to Bill O'Neill, Registrar of Voters for El Dorado County, and Jana Haynes, the Public Information Officer for Sacramento County. I really appreciate having the three of you on. I know we'll be in contact between now and a week from tomorrow. So good luck with everything that lies ahead for you.
Thanks, Randall.
Thank you so much, Randall.
Oh, you bet. And as always, you can learn more about any of the guests or segments you heard today here on Insight. Just do that at capradio.org/insight. And we have a ton of voter information there. And while you're online, send us your thoughts. What would you like to hear about on Insight? Shoot us an email. That's insight@capradio.org, or use the Ask Insight hashtag on Twitter. That's Insight for today. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, the digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Manada. I just want to thank you for joining us. I'm host Randall White, and we'll catch you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.